This is Breaking the Rules, a show for mental health professionals designed to help you build confidence in treating obsessive compulsive disorder. I'm Dr. Celine Gelgich, and I'm a clinical psychologist who works extensively with OCD.
And I'm Dr. Victoria Miller, but you can call me Tori. And I'm a clinical psychologist who works with young people, including those with OCD. Through our shared professional experience, we've found that effective treatment of OCD requires commitment, creativity, and the recognition that things can sometimes get a little messy.
They sure can. We want to empower clinicians to be able to work with their patients in new ways to treat OCD with confidence. Welcome to part two of our chat with Dr. Brett Deakin from the University of Melbourne. In case you missed part one, Brett is an Associate Professor of Psychology and Convener of the Clinical Psychology Program at the University of Melbourne. He received his PhD in Clinical Psychology at Northern Illinois University in the US and completed a postdoctoral fellowship at the Mayo Clinic under the mentorship of Dr. Jonathan Abramowitz. Since then, he has worked as an academic for 15 years and a full-time private practitioner for 5 years. His primary area of expertise is exposure therapy for anxiety and OCD. He is the co-author of Exposure Therapy for Anxiety, Principles and Practice. He has published extensively on therapist barriers to exposure therapy and strategies for overcoming them.
In part two of this episode, you will hear Brett delve into the data on safety behaviours, highlighting that the choices that parents make either enhance or diminish outcomes. He emphasises the importance of reducing accommodations, which are not just parent accommodations, by the way, because we all know that the more that we accommodate, the more anxious our clients become. Let's get started. Do you think the clinicians in the study were aware that they were engaging in anxiety-reducing behaviours all the time?
Well, I think what you end up getting, even if clinicians are following the same protocol, is you get natural variation in this sort of thing. And now we're sort of down to how much faith do therapists really have in exposure when push comes to shove? And how much faith do they have in the resilience of clients? And therapists vary on this stuff. And my students and I have spent time creating scales for measuring these therapist beliefs. And even in trials where highly trained people are doing the therapy, you still get this kind of variation, which actually speaks to one of my favorite study outcomes ever, is this pediatric OCD treatment study, the POTS study. And that's where these videos came from. The major POTS study, the first one that was done, was a multi-site study. And kids diagnosed with OCD were seen at Duke University and the University of Pennsylvania by exposure therapists who were following the same manual. And at the end of the study, the site difference in effectiveness was shocking. Therapists at the University of Pennsylvania, on average, had an effect size of symptom reduction that was more than 4 times higher than the therapist at Duke, even though they were following the same manual. And makes you wonder, well, what's the story? What happened there? And I spoke to Martin Franklin, who's the person in charge of the exposure protocol. And it turns out what happened is the therapists at Duke were used to working with kids, and they coddled them, essentially. They created easier exposure hierarchies and allowed it to take their time going through them. Whereas the pen therapists were used to working with adults and to really push things in a more intensive manner. And to hear Marty tell it, the therapist at Duke might have had a child touch the door handle, where the therapist at Penn might have that same child eat a sandwich off the bathroom floor. And they're both following the manual and they're both doing exposure therapy, but one of them, the intensive one, just works so much better.
Brett, what I wanted to ask actually is what therapy with you looks like. Because you mentioned before, you don't mind it being really intensive. You've got all of this knowledge about the unhelpful presence of safety behaviors. What does it look like in the room with you?
Well, I conduct an assessment in order to put together an individualized case formulation of the problem. And really the two main ingredients of the formulation are maladaptive learned beliefs about threat and the necessity of seeking safety from it, and avoidance and safety-seeking behaviors that the person has adopted that maintain the beliefs. That's the core of the model. So I think the first thing that would happen in therapy would be education about the model, about these mechanisms that maintain anxiety problems over time. and about how exposure therapy can be used to sort of interrupt the cycle that the person's in and allow them to acquire some new information from their own experience that can help them learn that the outcomes they fear are less likely to happen than they expect. And uncertainty that they might experience around that is more tolerable than they expect. And safety behaviors are not at all necessary in order for those things to be the case. And from there, we put our heads together and develop a list of potential exposures that we might do. And then we set out on our way. And to me, the most important thing is not where we start, because I'm confident that once the ball gets rolling, we'll be able to vary things and move our way up into more and more difficult exposures as we go. And I like to have that process of exposure initiated by probably the third session. So first session might be assessment, second session might be feedback and education. And by session three, we're off. And efficiency is an incredibly important aspect of therapy that is often underrated. And you know as well as I do that when we're working in the Medicare system, we often only have 10 one-hour long sessions with a client per year that they can get a rebate for, and be really easy to spend the first half of those sessions doing non-exposure stuff. And then by the time you get to the actual meat of therapy, you don't have enough time left. So I'd like to get there as early as possible. And I have faith that clients will find that they can handle exposure and will benefit from it. And rather than spending weeks or months trying to convince them of that at the intellectual level, I'm keen to just get the process started so that they can learn for themselves that they can do it.
I agree. I think that there's only so much that a client can hear us talk about, something that they just have to muck in and learn for themselves. And what I'm intuiting, I think, is that probably your confident demeanor enhances their willingness and preparedness to give it a try because you're so confident. So I can imagine that would really enhance their capacity to trust you. Would you agree with that?
100%. I've actually always wanted to study that because there's this interesting phenomenon where therapists who have negative beliefs about exposure are the same therapists who report their clients are resistant to it. And it just has to be the case that your confidence or lack thereof in exposure gets translated consciously or not to how the client perceives it. So yeah, I think that's a big part of it.
And I think like if the clinician is presenting in that way and maybe not actually saying it to their client, like they're probably feeling it through their hesitation or their willingness to negotiate an easier task or whatever else it might be. Like you're kind of inadvertently like perpetuating that narrative. One question I did have, if I'm allowed to ask, is would you classify things like, because a lot of clinicians, including us at times, will incorporate things like act-based strategies to kind of help the client regulate their distress while they're in that moment to help them build tolerance to the discomfort. Would you classify them as safety behaviors? Do you go cold turkey with everything?
Yeah, I probably would refrain from that. Really quick, like I like ACT and I incorporate some aspects of ACT into my thinking and philosophy and approach. But to me, you know, what does acceptance look like? To me, it looks like exposure.
Because that's how we've conceptualized it, I think, in our clinic, Tori. Would you agree? In terms of when we do introduce ACT-based strategies, we're very much don't label the disorder, label what you're experiencing, don't lose the chance at exposure, because otherwise that moment gets lost.
Again, that would be a really fun whole other conversation. But like one ACT strategy that I've seen lots of clients report psychologists using with them is to kind of diffuse from their thoughts and watch their anxious thoughts passing through their mind, like leaves on a stream, that sort of thing. But it's semi often been the case that I've had clients who saw an ACT therapist. And I sort of think of this continuum. On the one end, there's catastrophizing that their feared outcome is true and it's going to happen. It's going to be awful. And then in the middle of that continuum is allowing that thought to be there without trying to get rid of it. And I'm hanging out in the other end of the continuum, the far opposite end, which is let's lean into that thought and try to make it happen and make yourself as anxious about it as you can. So it sort of speaks to what's your inner monologue where your mind says, uh-oh, what if bad thing X is going to happen? What are you supposed to do? Well, some more act-minded psychologists might say, well, just allow that thought to be there. And I might say, tell yourself, oh no, X is definitely going to happen. My life is going to be ruined forever. And that's what it looks like for you to lean into the anxiety. And I want you to be pairing that with exposure and doing the opposite of safety behaviors. And if it's, I'm going to get contaminated and die a horrible death from an illness, if you're having that thought, then I want you to be leaning into that, both in terms of what you're doing in your mind and what you're doing with your actions. And so I guess, again, for me, I come back to that basic principle, anxiety up, good, anxiety down, bad. And for me, things that in theory are neutral, like mindfulness, often are used by clients to reduce their anxiety, if we're really being honest.
Because a lot of the time clients are like, well, I tried this and it didn't work. And the conversation goes something like, well, what do you mean by it didn't work? Well, I was still anxious. And often I'm like, well, that's the point. You know, we're supposed to be feeling the discomfort. It's not designed to make you feel better. It's not designed to make it go away. It's not designed to make you feel zen. It's designed for you to open up to the experience so you're not pushing it away.
I think that speaks to an absolutely critical issue, which is what mindset do we want clients to have regarding exposure and the process and what's expected of them before they even begin? And I think sometimes we are our own worst enemy because we're not still clear on that. And sometimes our approaches are actually a bit conceptually muddled, you know, like that, the multi-component CBT for mixed child anxiety. Well, what is it? Do I need coping skills because I can't handle anxiety, or do I do exposure because I can? Which is it? I'm confused, right? And so I go back to my personal trainer example at the gym. What's the mindset that we would want for a client who wants to become more fit and starts going to the gym and seeing a personal trainer? It's, you know what? This is going to be a pain in the butt, and I'm going to do it anyway because I know it will work. And I accept the fact that when I work out, I'm going to be miserable and exerting myself, but I understand that it will get better over time. And in the meantime, I'm basically just going to have to suck it up and go through this challenging experience, not with using a coping skill or practicing your mindfulness skills while you're on the treadmill, but just sort of saying, I am deliberately going to make myself really uncomfortable, and that's fine. And anything that deviates from that would tell me that they don't really get the concept of what it means to go to the gym and work out to be more fit. Because if you're simultaneously trying to minimize discomfort and maximize the acquisition of fitness, well, you can't do those two things at the same time.
While you're talking about that, Brett, I was thinking about myself at my strengths class and how much I am trying to minimize my distress and how much I tell myself that this is something to be coped with. So I think I'm going to need to have a look at my attitude and my safety behaviors while I'm at gym. I'm not sure that I've entirely got the concept right.
Do you guys feel like the gym analogy is a sort of an apt one when we're talking about exposure?
Oh, yeah, completely. I often do weave in a similar one talking about like building fitness, like building your fitness to do exercise versus building your fitness to tolerate anxiety. How strong can you get at the more you do it? And you won't get strong unless you do it. But I like the expansion that you bring in terms of using the safety behaviors and all the rest of it. It's going to hurt. And what's that age old saying? No pain, no gain.
Right.
When you mentioned the idea of walking slowly on the treadmill, that visual image was extremely powerful. The idea of that's what gentle exposure looks like. And I can really visualize how ineffective that would be if you were trying to build your fitness. And by comparison, just how ineffective that would be in an exposure context for a challenging OCD. It's very powerful.
Yeah.
We're getting to the end of our conversation today. And as Celine alluded to before, we are going to have to have you back, Brett, to continue this conversation because there is so much more research that you have undertaken that we haven't even gotten to today. But we've got some questions that we ask all of our guests when they come on our show. The first of which is, what is something that you know now that you wish you'd known earlier in your career?
That's a very good question. Something I know now that I wish I'd known earlier in my career probably would be the finer points of imaginal exposure, and in particular, doing exposure for people with unwanted intrusive thoughts involving harming others, harming themselves, being a pedophile, being actually secretly homosexual when their orientation is otherwise. When I ran my own practice for a while, I was surprised to learn that people being bothered by unwanted, upsetting, intrusive thoughts was actually that was the most common type of anxiety problem that people would present with. And that surprised me. I thought it might be phobias or social anxiety, but I think it speaks to this broader phenomenon that people don't really know or learn how to get along with their own mind very well. And I sort of think of a lot of what we see in the OCD world as fundamentally a problem of people unable to live in harmony with their own mind, who's doing what minds do. And how to understand that, conceptualize that, work with people around that, I found to be one of my most valuable clinical skills. But I had to sort of learn it after I left school, because in the world of sort of obvious exposure interventions that you might learn, that's pretty far down the list.
You know, that reminds me of supervision sessions I have with my clinical supervisor, who, you know, we often talk about this idea of how can you have these thoughts but live life anyway?
Right. And the thing is, you can't make the thoughts stop. And if you try, they get worse. And for me, this is where some of the ACT stuff is really useful. Like having unwanted internal experiences constantly is just part of the human condition. And you can either make peace with that reality or fight it, but you're not going to win the fight, right? And part of that also is understanding the nature of our mind and how our mind's going to have a mind of their own. And, you know, how to get along with this thing inside of you that you're stuck with that you can't get rid of.
Absolutely. It's really powerful. One of the other questions we ask our guests is, which is going off this idea of we all experience intrusive unwanted thoughts. It's just the way that our minds work. They're creative. Our brain's job is to think, right? Just the same way our heart's job is to pump blood and all the rest of it. And so would you be willing to share some of your intrusive thoughts that pop in?
All right. Here's a funny one from 2 weeks ago. So I had seen a client years ago who had a fear of hitting a person with his car while driving, and not so much losing control and steering the car into a person, but accidentally doing it and not even being aware that he did it. So he had a dash cam that every time he would get home, he would review the footage from his drive and he would go back and drive around to make sure there was no dead body on the side of the road and that sort of thing. And we did ERP for that. And the problem basically went away after a course of therapy, which was great. And I heard from him again recently. There's a new fear that had popped up. And that was the fear of having or acquiring hemorrhoids. And it turned out that there actually was some personal experience that would have led to that. And he recognized that it was sort of silly and unrealistic and not something that was likely to happen. But the way it would affect him is anytime he went to, let's say, bend down and pick something up or lift something heavy, he would safety behave his way through that in order to protect himself from that happening. And it just so happened that 2 days after that meeting, I helped a friend move. And so it was just he and I in a van, and I'm lifting this heavy stuff and I'm having intrusive thoughts about getting hemorrhoids. And I was chuckling at it. And I gave him a hard time about it when we had our next meeting. It's a great example of how the mind works. So he basically handed me an example of something to be concerned about. And it didn't occur to me until I started lifting heavy things. And then my mind started reminding me of his concern.
It's amazing at how the brain works through those associations.
Sure is.
Oh, what a riveting discussion. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Breaking the Rules, a show for mental health professionals designed to help you build confidence in treating obsessive compulsive disorder.
This podcast is brought to you by Melbourne Wellbeing Group, a psychology practice based in Melbourne with a special focus on treating OCD. To find out more, head to our website, melbournewellbeinggroup.com.au. All one word, that's melbournewellbeinggroup.com.au.
This podcast was made with strategy and production support from Wavelength Creative. To make sure you don't miss an episode of Breaking the Rules, be sure to subscribe to or follow the show in your podcast app. And while you're there, leave us a 5-star review. It really helps others find the show. I'm Celine Galgetch.
And I'm Tori Miller.
And we'll be back next episode with more reasons to convince you to get messy.
Have fun
and break the rules.